April 18th, 2021. Let's talk this morning about Chacham Ovadia Yosef, and I entitled the class Texts and Traditions. So allow me to briefly explain to you what I want to do. I want to do the opposite of what we generally do when we discuss Chacham Ovadia Yosef and his methodology. Generally speaking, what I've portrayed, I hope somewhat successfully, is that the direction of Pesach Halacha for Chacham Ovadia, generally speaking, favors texts over traditions. And what I mean by that is, if he notices, or noticed, he passed away already, that Am Yisrael practices one way, but he thinks, based on the history of Halacha, based on the development of Halacha, it should or should have been different, he will set out to write about how it should be changed. He'll set out to change communities' practices, even if they've done so for hundreds, if not thousands of years. He will change it, and he did so successfully on many of his campaigns. That's what I've described him as doing, almost in a singular fashion, that was his methodology, and I stand by that. There are several notable exceptions, and it's unfair of me to portray him as a singularly minded posek halacha. There are notable circumstances where he noticed a practice, even either across Am Yisrael or in recent generations in Israel, or whatever the circumstance may be, and he looks at that tradition or that practice, that custom, and he backs it up with sources, even though, as an outsider, knowing his methodology, you would have thought he'd go in a different direction. Why he does so in these specific circumstances, as opposed to in the majority of his situations, I invite you for speculation. But I'd like to give you three particular case studies in which he does so. So the first here is Minhag Gedola. Minhag Gedola, very briefly to introduce this, the Gemara in Masechet Berachot and one or two other places talks about the institution of two times on the Jewish day in which Mincha has a designated time. Once upon a time, of course, in the Mikdash, there was the Korban Tamid Shel Ben Ha'arbaim. And the question is, in Tfilat Mincha, which is established in the eyes of the rabbis in place of that Tamid Shel Ben Ha'arbaim, what's the appropriate time for that prayer? Well, the Gemara makes clear to us that on few circumstances, generally speaking, the Gemara specifically says it, on Erev Pesach Shehaliyot Be'erev Shabbat, which means to say, if it's the day before Pesach and it's a Friday, on that day, the Tamid Shel Ben Ha'arbaim would be brought from 6.5 hours into the day. 6.5 hours, generally speaking, we assume is Sha'ot Zemaniyot. You take all the daylight minutes of the day, add them together and then divide them by 12, and each one of those segments is an hour, irrespective of whether that's the way you do it. Some dispute that. 6.5 of those segments or hours into the day, that's when on Erev Pesach, Shehaliyot Be'erev Shabbat, they would bring that sacrifice in the Mikdash. When would they bring it on other days? Pretty much all other days, some years every single day. 9.5 hours into the day. The first one is what we refer to as Minhag Gedola, 6.5 hours into the day. And the second one is what we refer to as Minhag Ketana. Of course, it's a question not of how late it is, but how many hours you have left after you begin saying Mincha, or from that time. Like, why was it that on Erev Pesach they practiced differently than the rest of the year? Because the halakha is that a tamid, the sacrifice, needed to be brought before Korban Pesach. So you're dealing with Erev Shabbat, you can't bring Korban, you can't slaughter the Korban Pesach on Shabbat. In order to deal with that, the Tamid was brought at 6.5 hours into the day, which gave several hours now until sunset for people to deal with slaughtering their Korban Pesach. Okay, that introduction, if you didn't catch it all aside, it goes like this. There are two times during the day during which we talk about Mincha. Mincha Gedola, 6.5 hours into the day, and Mincha Ketana, 9.5 hours into the day. 99% of the time in the Mikdash, Mincha Ketana was the starting time of slaughtering that sacrifice. 1% or less of the time was Mincha Gedola. What's appropriate for us in terms of prayer? What's the appropriate start time for our Tfilat Mincha? This has been a question which was addressed, continues to be addressed, over the course of several hundred years. The Gemara never gives us an ideal and an unideal. The Gemara just matter-of-factly states these two times. Harambam, in source number 1, in Perek Gimel of Hilchot Tefillah, makes the following bold, but concrete suggestion. Kvar amarnu shetfilat mincha keneged zman tamid shel ben ha'arbaim tiknu zmana. So he says, I already told you, we already made clear at the beginning of Hilchot Tefillah that Tefillah is parallel to the Tamidim. The Tamid Shel Ben Harbaim, the second sacrifice, which was for the entirety of the nation, is Tefillat Mincha. Ulfi Shaya Tamid Karev Bechol Yom Betesha Umechza, Tiknu Zmana Mitesha Sha'ot Umechza. It's exactly as we described. Since generally speaking, the Mincha was brought at 9:30, so too that's what we do. Ulfi Shebe'erev Pesach Shechaliot Be'erev Shabbat Hayu Shohatin Et Tamid B'Shesh Umechza. Amru, listen to the word, Shehamit Palel Me'aharshesh Umechza Yasa. He says, the rabbis made clear that the avad, in unideal circumstances, 6.5 hours into the day, what we call mincha gedola, is sufficient. Ideally, really, what you're supposed to be doing is, from 9.5, umishihigia zeman ze, higia zeman chiyuva, from 6.5 hours in, that's when you technically can begin, but he's not excited about you beginning from mincha gedola. Continues Harambam in Halacha Gimal, and he tells us about what many of the Rishonim accepted as a practice. What many men would do is they would pray two minchas. They would pray mincha at mincha gedola, and then again at mincha ketana. That's right? They were a lot more religious than you and me. They were very excited about four prayers in the day. They would do two tefillot mincha. Now, clearly, we pray three times a day. That's what the Gemara tells us in many places. The Mishnah tells us that. So what would they do in this, in terms of two prayers? They would have in mind that one of them was tefillat nidava. One of them was just an additional prayer, whereas one of them was chovat tefila. Which one should be, in their mind, the primary tefillat mincha, and which one is the nidava, is the optional, is the supplementary one? Says Harambam, of course, tefillat mincha ketana from 9.5 hours in, that's the primary one. We just told you, that's the ideal. Mincha gedola is tefillat nidava. Harambam, when we boil it all down, is quite clear. If we're dealing with when to pray mincha, don't start mincha before 9.5 hours into the day. Now you might be scratching your head and saying, but just yesterday I prayed mincha gedola. I went to XYZ synagogue. I prayed mincha gedola. That's right. Harambam seems to be clear. He's not very excited about that. He does, in his Hilchot Yom Tov, accept this mincha gedola on Yamim Tobim. There's a question about whether he would extend it specifically and only to Shabbat. I will expose to you something. During the majority of the year, I pray mincha gedola. The majority of the year, I pray mincha in the yeshiva Flatbush at 2 o'clock. Mincha gedola. It's not a mincha ketana minyan. Certainly Harambam would not be very excited. He would say, you're yoseh, but it's only b'di'avad. It's not ideal. Is this everyone's vision? Again, we have two times mentioned in Talmud, never made clear which one you're supposed to prefer. So, you know, it's not like this is the time. If you did it then, the Gemara just has these two times. I remember as a student in 7th grade with Rabbi Weiner asking him, couldn't get a straight answer about this. Why do we have two minhas? We don't have two shahrits. Couldn't get a straight answer. It took me time to figure out. They were both signifying something else. And in turn, it makes you wonder which one's the primary. Rosh, in source number 2, Rosh Rabbeinu Asher ben Yehiel, later commentator, does yeshiva, oh, that's right. As Rei Braha asks, does any yeshiva in the world not pray mincha gedola? Keep that thought, Rei. And says Rei, every yeshiva. That's right. Rani, he's following in the tradition of Rabbi Aaron Schechter, and he's considering yeshiva Flatbush a litvisha yeshiva. How do you like that, right? But all yeshivot, they always pray mincha gedola. There's no question, and we're going to address that. That's really what underlies a lot of this issue. In other words, the fact that across the Jewish Orthodox world, if we're going to include yeshivot as, you know, quote, normal minyanim, the majority of minyanim certainly today are mincha gedola. Rosh, in source number 2, Rosh Rabbeinu Asher ben Yehiel, the father of Tur, right, an important 14th century first German and then a Spanish rabbi in his She'elot Tishbot Kelal Dalet Simantet, is addressing the same issue that Harambam did in Perek Gimal Halacha Gimal. In other words, he sees this reality in which people pray two times mincha. Which one should be the primary and which one should be the secondary? Which one's the real mincha and which one's nidava? I found the minyan, I'm going to pray with them. Today we don't do Tfilot Nedava very often for reasons we can discuss separately, but I'll state it to you very basically. The explanation of the poskim is we don't have the sort of kavana even for our primary tefillah, so you're now going to add extra tefillot, inappropriate to do so. Says Rosh, the opposite of Harambam. He says that if you're praying these two tefillot mincha, your first mincha, your mincha gedolah, that should be your primary one. Makes clear, it appears at least, that mincha gedolah is not just bidi'avad. It's not, shouldn't have done that. Well, make sure you get your mincha ketana. Rosh is on the other end of the spectrum, whereas Harambam says, seemingly, clearly, mincha ketana, 9.5 hours when my mincha should go. I'm following the way they did it in the Mikdash, 99.8% of the time. Rosh says, not so. 6.5 hours was a viable, appropriate time to bring the Korban Mincha, so they didn't bring it that way, the Tamid Shel Ben Arbaim, so what? That doesn't change anything in terms of the Chatechila or Bidi'avad. So 6.5 hours is just as significant, maybe even more significant for Rosh than, of course, Harambam. How did this follow through in terms of Pesach Halacha? And source number 3, Tur, following on the holding on to the curtails of his father, Zmana, Siman Resh Lamid Gimal, Mishesh Sha'ot Mechsel Lema'ala Ad Halayla, Mincha, he doesn't distinguish from 6.5 hours and onward until Shkiat HaHama. Tur says, seemingly in a very simple language, like his father Rosh, no problem, don't consider it subpar, unideal to pray mincha gedolah. Bet Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of Shulchan Aruch, brings these different opinions and makes clear, as he generally would, that if he's faced with a deliberation between Harambam and Rosh, Harambam is a lot weightier for him. Harambam is a posek halacha upon which much of his book is built. It's true, he says, I'm going to weigh on a scale the 3 poske halacha of Rif Rosh Harambam, or Rif Harambam and Rosh, but if I have one against the other, generally speaking, even one against two, if it's Harambam, he follows the opinion of Harambam, and therefore in source number 5, in Shulchan Aruch, in Siman Resh Lamid Gimal, Shulchan Aruch is posek halacha mi sheitpalel tfilat hamincha la'achar she unideal is something called mincha gedolah from 6.5 hours up. Ikar zimana, the proper time to pray mincha, the ideal time is, of course, mitesha sha'ot u'mehseu lema'ala. That seems pretty open and shut. Radvaz, in source number 6, a contemporary of Shulchan Aruch, of Rabbi Yosef Karo, his name is Rabbi David ben Zimra, he spends time in Egypt, spends time afterwards in Israel. In his Sheilot to Shabbat Chelek Bet, Siman Tafresh Ayin Vav, he's asked the question, Al Mashin Nahagu, listen to the words, Ray already, Lit Palel Min Hagedolah. It's already existent in his time. Many people are praying Min Hagedolah. Umiksatam Min Haketana. Some, the minority of the community of the people pray 9.5 hours in. And you have to imagine, as we'll see suggested later on, that this wasn't necessarily a mindful decision as much as a practical one. When were people out together with others? When they came home at night, there was little electricity. I don't know, I could be wrong about this. I don't know that they're oftentimes making their way out to synagogue to pray as much as when they're in work, in the market or whatever. So people are together, that's mincha gedolah time. Makes a lot of sense before yeshivot in the institutionalized sense as we have them today. That mincha gedolah would be the more convenient, easiest way to convene a minyan and to pray that way. Says Radvaz, I know people pray this mincha gedolah thing, but Harambam thinks it's unideal. And as a result, he says, I think the ideal approach is to pray mincha ketana. Wait until 9.5 hours into the day. Only then should you be praying mincha. Well, that being the case, again, we're already noticing in the time of Radvaz, the minhag is, which is Biyosef Karo, against Harambam. Shulchan Aruch certainly wants to dispel of that in his work. Shalmei Tzibur, a rabbi we talked about a bunch last week, Rabbi Yisrael Yaakov Elgazi, he's a Turkish and then Israeli rabbi living, I think he born in the 17th century, primarily functions as a rabbi in the 18th century. In his book, Shalmei Tzibur, he writes the following, Noraot Nifleti. I was perplexed and very bothered. Al haminhag, on the custom, the tradition, shenahagu bechol kelilot Yisrael, kama vekama chachamim v'yirei Hashem v'choshvei Shemo litpalel mincha gedola neged Pesach Maran asher mipiv anu hayim. I can't believe it. So many people. 350 years ago, so many people pray Mincha Gedolah against Shulchan Aruch. We follow Shulchan Aruch. On Erev Shabbat, he says, on Friday afternoon, okay, might be hard to gather the people. You have them at the right time, and then you pray Adbit later. Okay, I could see a pass over there. I'll call it Sha'at HaDahak. It's not ideal, but what can I do? He says, but what about throughout the week? Why is it that throughout the week people are praying Mincha Gedolah? He is very bothered by this. We understand so. Why. We, if you've been following until now, we in our halachic minds imagine this is going to be on the wall of Chacham Ovadia Yosef's study hall, right? In his office, he's going to put Shalmei Tzibur and he's going to say, therefore, no minhag edolah. The minhag is a mistaken one. Continue Shalmei Tzibur and he says, you know something? Arizal, Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, he would always pray at Shkia, right as the sun was going down. And he says, Bet Yos, and he would make sure also there was always Hazara. He gets into a conversation about Hazara, not to do with Kol Ram and so forth. But as clear Shalmei Tzibur is, Rabbi Israel Yaakov Elgazi, he says, this is the minhag. I don't know what to do about this. I think we have to change it. In his Shalmei Tzibur earlier in the book, he cites from Zohar in Parashat Hayesara. The words in Zohar in Parashat Hayesara seem to suggest that Mincha starts, this part we know that it starts, but it seems to be accepting even the Chatechila at Mincha Gedolah time. Oh, that's interesting. So you have a Kabbalistic source which seems to direct us against Tarambam. No news there. But what happens? And then he concludes in a funny way. He says, and you know, that's why the Arizal prayed at Shkiat HaHama, which seems somewhat contradictory, is pointed out. But Zohar already, on our list of those who think that Mincha Ketana is a viable, maybe even the Chatechila option, so we have Tur, we have Rosh, we have Zohar. On the other side, and you look at my hands the way I'm doing the scale, we have Harambam. Harambam certainly is still in the picture of Pesach Halacha going to be weightier, even, it appears, than Zohar, if Zohar wasn't followed by adherents of Arizal and others. I bring you forward to 20th century literature, and I'm skipping over a bunch, but I'm giving you the main picture in terms of how this stuff developed. Shoel v'nishal helikim al siman kuf. Shoel v'nishal is Rabbi Moshe Kalfon HaKohen. He's a Tunisian rabbi. He's from Jerba. Gam mevuar sham delechat tehillayin leitpalel min hagdola v'rak bedi'avad yasa v'chen b'sha'at ha'daha katvu ha'poskim. He says you should not be praying Mincha Gedolah unless it's Sha'at HaDahak, it's a pressing circumstance. And as a result, he says, that's the minhag in my community here in Jerba. I mean, he lives until into the 1970s, if I'm not mistaken. Ulfi aniyutati, he writes in the second paragraph, and this is the interesting part. If you have a choice of whether to pray Mincha Gedolah with a minyan or Mincha Ketana biyahid, which one should take preference? Mutav litpalel mincha ketana biyahid militpalel mincha gedolah berabim. He says, Sha'at HaDahak, a pressing circumstance, needs to be defined accordingly. Not so simple. You have a choice at work and they're praying Mincha Gedolah. You'll have a minyan, or when you get home, you won't be able to make it back out. You'll have to pray biyahid. Pray at home biyahid. Why so? That's the ideal time. Minyan is nice, but it's not a hova. Tefillah bizmana is a hova, to do it in the most ideal time. Now that's interesting again. This is running counter, as Shalmei Tzibur said, to the practice. It's running counter, as Ray said, to the practice of the yeshivot, certainly in the 20th century, in his time period as well. His contemporary dies a little bit later, and B'Matzliach Mazuz and She'elot Tishbot Ish Matzliach, Helek Aleph Siman Tetvav, writes accordingly, no Mincha Gedolah, what's with Mincha Gedolah? In parentheses at the end, as a matter of fact, he writes, V'rak behemshech hadorot mechisaron yedi'a v'hoda'a nishtarbev la'achirim. This Mincha Gedolah thing was just for the lay people. As time went on, there was a mistaken thing that everyone began to pray Mincha Gedolah. It was really just something for the laymen who were in the marketplace and they didn't have a way of praying another way. What's that? Really, how's this going to take shape? I mean, we're making our way into 20th century. It seems to still be the practice, but nobody seems too excited about it. It's true, we had Rosh, we had Tur, but nobody seems too excited about this. I mean, we're preferring praying B'yachid. In fact, Chacham Ben Tzion Abba Shaul, in source number 11, of course, the Rosh Yeshiva Porat Yosef, dies at the end of the 20th century, and his Or L'Tzion Chelek Bet, Perek Tetvav Ot Bet, he deals with this situation as well, this question, and he's posek accordingly. He says, listen, Mincha Gedolah is not ideal. A choice of whether to pray Mincha Gedolah with a minyan or Mincha Ketana without a minyan, Mincha Ketana without a minyan. But what are you talking about, minyan? He says, yeah, Maran, Biosef Karo, and Siman Sadi, Saif Tet, right? Yishtadel Adam Litpalel Bevet HaKneset Im HaSibur. You should really be trying your hardest to pray with a Sibur, with a minyan. But when it comes down to it, prayer, Bizmana, that takes preference to even a Yishtadel Me'ot, to the nice and important zechut of praying with a minyan. All right, again, I pose to you the question, what's he going to say about the yeshivot? He's not going to be excited. He does rationalize the yeshivot. He does say, listen, they have something on me this morning, but he's not excited about that. He's not excited about it, and it appears to me that the majority of the poskei halacha are not and have not been excited about the reality that A, in the yeshivot, they pray Mincha Gedolah, and B, in businesses, many people will pray Mincha Gedolah. Now, we're not talking about impressing circumstances. I don't know, like we said earlier, Erev Shabbat. Maybe a Shabbat afternoon, there's a little bit more of a leniency as well, especially if it's for Torah and so forth. We're talking about a general standard practice. Nobody seems too excited about it. To the extent, I remember, I was unfamiliar with this, as I told you. In seventh grade, I asked my rabbi, and I didn't understand the difference between the two. But I had a friend, he's a rabbi in the community now, who was well-versed in these halachot. And I remember we were in Israel, and it was Friday afternoon, we were at the Kotel. So I chapped a mincha minyan, but he stood next to me. I realized he wasn't praying. He didn't tell me why he wasn't praying. We finished praying. So why didn't you pray with me? Well, you just stood there. He said Tehillim or something. He said Mincha Gedolah. I was really unfamiliar with the point. I said, I'm not going to pray Mincha Gedolah. And that night we were praying at Hachamova. We were going to Har Nof. We were praying at Hachamova. I thought maybe he was doing it for that. No, he was doing it because Mincha Gedolah versus Mincha Ketana. I said, we're at the Kotel. Where you got? Okay, Mincha Gedolah. That was and is the perspective of many. So Hacham Ovadia Yosef, it's in source 13, but we'll pray. I'm going to talk about that meal right now. I know he writes it in the. I mean, I'll talk about it right now beforehand. The meal that we're nervous about is that from the time that Mincha begins, in other words, when you can pray, you shouldn't be eating meals. So for example, to bring it back to the yeshiva, which is part of Chacham Ovadia's rationale, in yeshivas, they're going to serve lunch. You just finish shi'ur and you're going to have lunch and you pass the time very often of Mincha Gedolah. So we don't want you sitting down and having lunch because the fear is your lunch and your meal is inappropriate before prayer. It might carry you in too long and so forth. And so the fear in turn is, according to Halakha, Siman Resh Lamed Be'et, you're not supposed to get haircuts after the time of Mincha Gedolah until you pray. You're not supposed to have meals. You're not supposed to do all sorts of work if you're not already involved in it and so forth. So that is a counterclaim, which Chacham Ovadia will address, of saying, well, this is Sha'at HaDahak. We need to have our meal, and we're going to have the meal anyway. The counter, the response to that, that Chacham Ben Tzion says, not really, because when it comes down to it, you have a specific time for the meal, right? In the yeshiva, the lunchroom is closed at a certain time. You're not getting stuck at that meal. This is different than the regular circumstance in which we fear, and it's inappropriate, says Siman Resh Lamed Bet, in having the meal beforehand. But that's the question. As a matter of fact, in the book Minhat Aharon, and then it was copied again in Halichot Olam Chelek Aleph, Cham Aharon Shweka from Egypt wrote a letter to Chacham Ovadia Yosef. They had been together in Egypt for several years, and he was asking about this. He says, you know, everybody has their meals before the tefillah, and they wrote back and forth about this matter and touched on Mincha Gedolah, and Chacham Ovadia Yosef rationalized it and concludes, as we'll see in just a moment in his Teshuvah as well, in Yehaveh Da'at, many of the yeshivot and kolelim do this, yesh lehem al mi lismoch, which again, I take a pause in the context of our class, of our methodological discussions. Very surprising. Not where we think he's going. We think he's just going to hang on to everyone else and say, that's right, this is terrible, change it. In my yeshiva, we don't do it this way. And It's not what he does on this matter. First and foremost, he brings forth, he's not the first to do so, She'elotu Teshubot Rif. Rif, Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, right, lives in northern Africa, to the best of my knowledge. Not much time, if any, in Morocco, although he gets that name from Fez. Maybe he was born there. And anyway, She'elotu Teshubot Harif in Siman Shin Chaf has an identical approach to Rosh. Rif as well seems to be fully embracing and okay with Minha Gedolah. Now, why was that not a part of our equation? As we mentioned earlier, as we've mentioned on so many occasions, Shulchan Aruch bases himself on the three major poskei halacha, Harambam, Rif before him, and Rosh. Now, over here, it seems like not a no-brainer, but you have Harambam saying Minha Gedolah is not ideal, and you have Rosh and Rif saying that it is ideal. That's it. It should be done. It's two versus one. Why didn't Shulchan Aruch and Siman Resh Lamed Gimel do so? As we've mentioned on more than one occasion, Shulchan Aruch did not have access to She'elot Teshubot Harif, not any of them, but to most of them, he didn't have access. He had never seen the She'elot Teshubot Harif, that which we have today. He didn't have, which of course raises the question, what do we do with discoveries after Shulchan Aruch's time of poskim that he clearly would care very much about? What does Chacham Ovadia Yosef say? He tells us it's easy. Had he seen it, he wouldn't have been posek halacha the way he is. And as a result, change the halacha. That's consistent in his methodology. But keep in mind what he's doing over here. He has running up against one another. On the one hand, the statement throughout that we shouldn't be doing this minhag edolah. And on the other hand, the defense of the minhag ha'olam, let's call it, the minhag of many to pray minhag edolah, he brings into the equation rif. He'll do this from time to time. We've mentioned it in the context of Yayin Mevushal. We mentioned he'll do this from time to time. He'll enter it into the equation. We'll discuss very briefly the ramifications of that again. And he'll as well, very uncharacteristic, but he's trying to be Miyeshe. He says, you know, Zohar, take a look in source number 13. He says, Vine b'shalmet zibur, in the second paragraph, Katav, Shalmet zibur, we know, Rabbi Elgazi, Ulam nira, sheyesh liyashev ha-minhag al pi divrei ha-Zohar ha-Hadash, the first vantage point of defense is, or the first point of defense is, Zohar. Very not Chacham Ovadia Yosef. Generally speaking, he says we go based on the Nigla sources, not on the Nistar Kabbalistic sources. He starts here, he's defending. Furthermore, he contends, Rif is on Rosh's side. It's true, Shulchan Aruch didn't have it. Then he continues, says Rabbeinu Saadia Gaon, and several others are of that opinion, and his conclusion goes as follows. I'm not going to tell you not to pray Mincha Ketana. But I am going to tell you that the yeshivot, yesh lahem al mi lismoch. And if you are posed, not in the yeshiva, with the question of to pray mincha gedolah with a minyan, or mincha ketana without a minyan, mincha gedolah with a minyan, of course. That's his claim, that's his statement. Not what we were, in my mind, not what we were expecting. Not what he generally does. His general vantage point is, let's overthrow the system. Now again, and this is the real reason I wanted to do this today more than anything, is that sometimes it comes across in these classes as if tradition is tradition and that will override all. Minhag mevatel halacha, to the extent that I don't care if there are source. No, there always has to be solid grounding and source work. So Chacham Ovadia Yosef will provide for you the source work. That's why I called the class Texts and Traditions. He's defending the tradition uncharacteristically, but he's doing so with sources. That's his vantage point. That's the way he goes about doing so. It's not such a clear defense, I will add as well, which is why it's somewhat surprising he does so. First and foremost, it's Harambam. Harambam, as I've mentioned several times, carries a lot of weight. As source number 15, the He'arot in the Mishnah Berurah Ish Matzliach point out, doesn't matter if Rif and Rosh go up against Harambam, sometimes we go like Harambam. Secondly, as I've mentioned in the past, there's a big debate in the poskim about how we envision the words of Shulchan Aruch. Is it a closed book and we follow it, irrespective of the sources he didn't have and could have had? Or is it an open book for development? Chacham Ovadia Yosef will tell you it's open for development based on sources we find later, but based on my determination, right? In other words, I'm not going to tell you that if the Zohar said one way or Arizal said one way, that we'll defend. But others, most notably, we quoted from Biakov Chaim Sofer in the name of Chacham Ben Siona Bashaul. The words, I know Eddie doesn't like them, but I'll remind you just so you remember the class, the words are that Shulchan Aruch was written with Ruach HaKodesh, which means to say, divorcing it of its spirit. spiritual side. The book is done, and as a result, that is normative practice, irrespective of any later discoveries. This is case study number one, however. The question of Minhag Gedolah, whether it being ideal or not, Chacham Ovadia Yosef, instead of coming out combatively against it, is defensive. And he does a decent job at defending it, to the extent that I'm not giving him all the credit, but I am going to tell you, this is certainly in the Sephardic world, but even certainly in the Ashkenazic world as well, Minhag Gedolah is not a bygone, lost tradition. It's practiced, and people don't even feel uncomfortable. Unlike my friend, people, generally speaking, don't feel uncomfortable, even in non-pressing circumstances, praying Minhag Gedolah. All right, that's case study number one. Case study number two, again, what we're going to develop and find is a practice which we expect to be demolished by Chacham Ovadia. There being textual evidence contrary to it, and yet he will defend it in a time-honored fashion. Here's the issue. The issue is, I addressed this on one occasion, but I didn't develop it fully, and I don't think it was on recording either, is Shulchan Aruch in Siman Sadi Aleph in Ora Chaim Sa'if Gimal writes the following. Yesh omrim she'asur lehotzi azkara mipiv birosh migule. There is an opinion in Rishonim and Aharonim alike that you're not allowed to make a beracha or mention God's name if your head is exposed, if you don't have a covering on your head. V'yesh omrim, and there are alternatively those who say, she'yesh limchot shelo likanes bet ha'kneset b'gilui harosh, not alternatively, additionally, you shouldn't even enter into the synagogue with your head exposed. Now, we're not addressing, as Shulchan Aruch does in Siman Dalid, walking without a kippah, without a head covering. We're talking about saying berachot. Berachot, tefillot, entering synagogue, we'll extend it to Talmud Torah, when you mention God's name and God's words. Those are the words of Shulchan Aruch. I can tell you, to the best of my knowledge, men have, for quite some time, been very careful about this, to the extent that there's the silly this, when they'll put their arm onto their, just to have their head covered, right? I mean, that's what they'll do. You know, that Shulchan Aruch, Siman Sadi Aleph. What about women? Now, when I was younger, as I've mentioned on one or two occasions, I do remember in Sha'ar Esion, there used to be doilies for women who entered into the synagogue. I don't know if that's still existent. I do know for some time, yeah, right? In Beit Torah, there are doilies. And all the women who enter put on...
My mom always wears it.
Oh, how interesting. Okay, so that... Wait, certainly in Mikdash Eliyahu there are no doilies. In Sha'ar Shalom there were no doilies. And even these small, the fabric yarmulkes, whatever they are, I don't see women putting those on either. I do know they used to. The cone style, tent style one. You don't see that all that often. You once did, not even up across the board. It was, generally speaking, to the best of my knowledge, the married women who would do so. What about unmarried women? I was like, okay, let's assume married women, okay, the halacha is they're covering their hair anyway. What about unmarried women? So they're not covering their hair anyway. Shulchan Aruch is saying he's not differentiating between men and women. Why should we differentiate? In fact, in source number 17, in She'elot HaTeshubot Sitz Eliezer, in Chelek Yod Bet, Siman Yod Gimel, that's Rabbi Waldenberg, who's a contemporary of the same rabbis we've been discussing. He actually even hung out with them, with Chacham Ovadia and Chacham Ben Tzion Abba Shaul. They were both living in Jerusalem in the early, mid-1900s, and he, Rabbi Waldenberg, was interested in Pesach Halacha, what Ashkenazi was involved in Pesach Halacha at the time. So he hung out with the Sfaradim. I think he even learned a little in Porat Yosef. Chacham Baruch described him. It's transcribed in the book Torat Chacham Baruch. He says he was very diligent. He wasn't, a part that can be contested. He said he wasn't a mavrik, he wasn't brilliant, but he was very diligent, and look how successful he was. All right, you have to read his Tishu B'Av. You'll be the arbiter of whether he was brilliant or not. Anyway, in his Sitz Eliezer in Chelek Yod Bet, he was asked, he doesn't say by whom, but he says he was asked, why is it that many of the Shelemim v'Haredim L'Dvar Hashem, many of the scrupulous, God-fearing, halachic, observant homes and women who are single don't cover their head when they make berachot, and when they say tefillah, and they learn Torah? Why is it? How could they be doing so? Shulchan Aruch doesn't distinguish in Siman Sadi Aleph. There is no reason to distinguish. He finds a rationale. You'll have to read it, and decide, I didn't put it on here, and decide whether you're convinced by it, but I will tell you that the last line of this first paragraph in source number 17, listen to these words. Ha'emet agid, I'll tell you the truth, says Rabbi Waldenberg. She'amadati mishtomem, I stood puzzled, kisha'a hada, for an hour. In other words, it's an expression in which he says, I don't know why. I'm so surprised. Never thought about that. Why are they?
The way that the question is posed, like as if the Shulchan Aruch was posek this way, but he says Yesh Omrim.
It's, but there's no other opinion recorded. It's a Yesh Omrim v'Yesh Omrim, and they're both the Humrah. You are correct, Eddie. You
say it that way.
He does do that, not too unoften. You know, it's the classic conversation I've had with people in which they say you obscure matters by mentioning so many sources. You may as well just say we do like this. And I say, but Shulchan Aruch so often tells us Stam v'Yesh Omrim, and you know, or Yesh Omrim, when he just wants us to follow that. It's not fully clear always why he'll do that. He certainly is giving credence to the other approach, and it might be argued, as Eddie is, that the women in his time period weren't, and that's why he just does it as a Yesh Omrim, even though he doesn't give you another opinion. But he does seem keen on this being the practice. I mean, the fact that he doesn't give you an alternative, although he hints at it, I will accept with the Yesh Omrim.
In Shaylo, women, really. I mean, we're assuming that he's,
but why should he be distinguishing? He doesn't say just man. Why would you distinguish? I know we distinguish because of practice, but you have to take a step back and take yourself out of what we do. Why should you distinguish? In Shailot Shabbat Yaskila Abdi Chalek Zayin on page Resh Petet, this is Chacham Ovadia Hadaya. His nephew Chacham Shaul Kasim writes to him the following, asks him the following question: Asher la she'ela odot habahurot halomdot bebatei sefer haharedim. I don't know if it's Yeshiva Flatbush, the Haredi institution in Brooklyn that Chacham Shaul is asking about, or if it's Mag and David, both very Haredi institutions. Shelo nahagu lechasot harosh bizman shelomdot divrei kodesh, Tanakh, Mishnah, v'Talmud. They study Torah in the school, and they're not covering the head. Mechem b'sha'at tefillah, so too when they pray. Uberachot, v'katamazon, v'chadomeh. Im yesh lahem amash yismochu. Do they have something upon which they can lean on? Words, I understand it's not ideal, says Chacham Shaul, it sounds like, to Rabbi Hadaya, but they have something they could go on. Says Chacham Ovadia Hadaya, in short, no. You got to go out and change this. And anyone who doesn't change this, he finishes the paragraph here at the very bottom of 18. Hakolar mutal. Kolar is a noose. The noose is hanging, dangling on al hagidolim, on the leaders. Sheyesh bi adam limchot, who can change this practice. In other words, this is on your head. Go out and change it. A very, in my mind, in our methodological description, a Chacham Ovadia Yosef type of description. This is wrong. Change it. Shelo tishbot ish matzliach ora hayim siman kuf chafdalet. Rabbi Matzliach Mazuz, who we mentioned earlier, he describes this as, I was asked about this issue. I want you to know, in Jerba, in Tunisia, all the single women always cover their head. I don't know about those funny places where people, women aren't covering their head when they make berachot. Of course they should be covering their head. Of course that's what we've done. Of course that's what should be done. Aval etzlenu, he writes at the end in the second paragraph, shamati shibimkomot achirim nohagim shabtulot mevarchot mitpalot begilu erosh. Okay, I did hear there are other practices. He says, I might be able to rationalize it. Not so really excited about it. We'll talk about that rationalization in just a minute. Aval etzlenu, he concludes the paragraph, halila lehatir bezeh kelal. It's a heaven forbid should we be matir. Okay, he's reflecting what apparently is the nohag in his place. I did see later, I forgot specifically where, there are those who claim that he may have been exposed to a different reality in Jerba than others. I can't really tell you. In other words, certainly he's describing what he knows. He's being honest to us that he knows that women who are single covered their head for these matters. She'elot Tishubot Ma'ane Lashon in source number 20. Again, our second case study is revolving around the issue of Shulchan Aruch tells us in Siman Tzadi Aleph, he writes that you should cover your head when you say Berachot, when you mention God's name. And we're now questioning in the 20th century, sounds like the earliest time of questioning this, but wait a second, single women at the very least aren't covering their head when they do these things. What we've seen in several sources is, well, they should be. In She'elot Tishbot Ma'ane Lashon Chelek Aleph Ora Chaim Siman Aleph, I saw this cited somewhere, I can't tell you his biography, it'd be Moshe Hafuta. I found the book on Osara Chochma, he was a rabbi in Petach Tikva. He's writing, he's responding to the son of source number 19, to Rabbi Meir Mazuz. He says, your brother, Rabbi Tzemach Mazuz, spent some time with me. He gave me your father's book. I want you to know, not so excited about what he wrote so unequivocally that women, even when they're single, have to be covering their head for all of these berachot. He said, I can't really fully and completely give you the reason. I can tell you, it's not what they've done. I'll tell you perhaps that the best of my sources, he writes, is that the reason we cover our head during those times is mishum kalut rosh. Kalut rosh means lightness of head, inappropriate thoughts, and you put something on your head in order to maintain the proper concentration. It's possible that that issue didn't or doesn't apply to women, and as a result, something that was codified as our practice never existed amongst women. That's the best of his rationale. But he's not too excited. He writes, I don't love that your father, Rabbi Masluach Mazuz, was so adamantly opposed to women leaving their heads exposed during the time of Berachot Tefillah and mention of God's name. Okay, now I bring it to Chacham Ovadia Yosef, but first, with a brief story in source number 21, in Torat Chacham Baruch Chelek Bet, on page 104 through 105. Chacham Baruch Ben Chaim, of course, was a rabbi in the Syrian community for many years. His brother-in-law is with Chacham Shaul, was brother-in-law with Chacham Shaul Kassin, and recently they've collected some of his, or listened to some of his classes, wrote them down, and, you know, it's one of those types of books that the footnotes far outnumber the words at the top of the page. But okay, there's a lot of interesting things nonetheless in the book, in addition to the footnotes. And here in
the footnotes are not
Chacham Baruch? No, and it's not a secret. The footnotes are written, I forgot his name, a Syrian young man and others in Lakewood now. But this is not from the footnotes. This is from the top. This is what they heard in one of the classes. Chacham Baruch says, it's right there, if I'm not mistaken, in Siman Tzadi Aleph in Shulchan Aruch. He says, I'm going to tell you the following story with regards to this halach. He says, when I was younger, there was a rabbi in Jerusalem. His name was Rabbi Sadka Hussein. And Rabbi Sadka Hussein, I know from other stories that Chacham Ovadia Yosef told, was a little bit of a zealot. He was into setting things the way they should be. And, you know, he was strong in his approach, takif, in his approach to matters of community and practice. So he gathered Talmidei Chachamim Shebirushalayim. He gathered many of the, sounds like the Sephardic rabbis at the time period, into one meeting. And Chacham Baruch says, I was a young man and I was there as well. And he got up in front of us and he said to us, Shulchan Aruch writes in Siman Tzadi Aleph that you need to cover your hair during these times of mentioning God's name. Why is it that the young women or women who aren't married don't cover their hair when they say Berachot, Tefillah, and Talmud Torah? Shouldn't that be changed? Says Chacham Baruch, and the room was left silenced. Said Rabbi Hussein, you see, from your silence you've proven to me that you agree with me. This is wrong. We have to set out and change this. And then in the second paragraph, Ve'az panai elai, Rabbi Hussein turned to the young Chacham Baruch and he says to him, I'm appointing you, mina oti le'adpis moda'ot. I'm appointing you to print moda'ot. I imagine pashkevillin, signs to put up on the streets that we're changing this, that all women need to cover their head during times of Berachot, Tefillah, and Talmud Torah. And Chacham Baruch says, I audaciously stood up to him and I said, you know something? Halacha is determined by our practice, and I can tell you, I've never seen this. I'm injecting words now. I haven't seen this by my aunt, by my grandmother, by my sisters, and so forth. And as a result, I'm uncomfortable writing signs against what I know rabbinic and God-fearing families have been practicing for quite some time. That's the story as Chacham Baruch tells it. Again, not enough to prove halakha. Enough to begin the conversation and to negate the claim against it. You need to start the conversation, but now you need to back it. Now you need to source it. A tradition is not sufficient. A tradition is already establishing something as pok hazeh mayamadava minhag mevatel halacha, but it must have solid grounding. Again, if nothing else comes out of this class, it's that. I know we've said it many times, but never forcefully enough. Says Chacham Ovadia Yosef in his Shelot Shebot Yabia Omer Chelek Vav in Ora Hayim Siman Tet Vav, is I'm going to rationalize this. I'm going to explain this matter to you. Now, he does conclude, and before I say anything else, I'm just going to mention this. He does conclude that ideally we should be encouraging single women to cover their head, married women as well, if they're not covering in general, for Amidah, he doesn't want them saying Bekot Kriyat Shema, for different segments of prayer, it is appropriate for them. He says that at the very end. Mikol makom nirah li shelechol hapachot betfilat shmoneh esrei yasimu kisui al roshan, they should cover their head for that. Now, what is the rationalization for the Nohag? For the fact, as we've seen, Tzitz Eliezer told us, Chacham Baruch told us, others have told us, Chacham Shaul told Rabbi Hadeya, the women are not doing so, the young women are not doing so. Says Chacham Ovadia Yosef, I'll tell you where it stems from, or at the very least how I can support it. Says the Gemara in Masechet Berachot and Daf Samech lists, and for one reason or another, with this Gemara has come up in several classes this year. It lists the morning routines. It says Ki Mita'er, when you wake up in the morning, you should say the following Berachot. Right when you hear the rooster crow, I don't know, make its noise, you should say Hanoten Lasechvi Bina Lefchin Ben Yom Ven Laila, and so forth. All the Berachot that we're familiar with. Harambam Rosh. Read that Gemara in quite a literal fashion. In other words, it's describing the proper order of saying those berachot in the morning. It's not just happenstance describing when this happens and when that happens, but there can be a different order. It must be done, or it should be done and will be done in that order. The Gemara is describing it in such a fashion. The Gemara describes over there several berachot, and only then does it say, when you put a covering on your head, should you say, Oter Yisrael Betifara. It seems clear from the Gemara that berachot that preceded Oter Yisrael B'tifara were said without a covering on your head. Say several of the important poskim, Gaon Mivilna, Peri Hadash, and others. It seems clear from the Gemara that Me'ikar Hadin, letter of the law, you don't need to cover your head as you say berachot. Now again, this will not be accepted by all. Shulchan Aruch certainly told us you should be covering your head. Harambam seems to suggest so as well. You should be covering your head as you say the berachot. However, says Chaim Vadya Yosef, there clearly is a dispute with sourcing on whether it's an absolute necessity in order to cover your head as you say berachot. That is his suggestion as a rationale. He says that what developed was men accepted the stringent approach that we won't make berachot without covering our head. Women apparently accepted the alternative approach, that of Gaon Mivilna, Peri Hadash, and others. That's his rationalization. Again, why do I mention it in this context? Because not exactly what I was expecting. I was expecting him to overthrow everything. I was expecting him to take the approach of Chacham Ovadia Hadaya. Really? Your single women are not making berachot? Well, you better teach them better. You should follow the practices of Jerba. Make sure all the women do so. Not what he does. He rationalizes. He does conclude and encourages that they cover their head for specific segments. But fundamentally, he brings support for the practice. Again, more than anything, pointing out to us that to singularly portray him as an individual who's only inspired by texts and doesn't give credence to custom and practice as well would be unfair. So maybe I've been a little unfair in the past. Lastly, I'll give you the last of my favorite examples of such. It goes as follows. I don't know about you, but I've eaten in restaurants in Brooklyn. And restaurants in Brooklyn, of course, which have hashgacha, high-level hashgacha, if you've ever looked into the way their kitchens are put together and run, what happens is the mashgiach turns on the oven for the workers, who are generally speaking non-Jews, and only then do the non-Jews put the food on the fire and into the oven. And they make all sorts of foods. I mean, go into any pizza shop. It's non-Jewish people, generally speaking, who are doing that work. Isn't that a problem? The Mishnah in Masechet Avodah Zarah, the Gemara afterwards, in Daf Lamed Het, talks about Bishul Akum, about not eating food which is produced, which is made by a non-Jewish person. Now, to be certain, there are specific circumstances within which there are permissibilities, but is this a permissibility that they put on the oven or the stovetop? Is that sufficient to get around this issue of what we call Bishul Akum? Shulchan Aruch in Siman Kuf Yod Gimal begins by telling us, generally speaking, again, provided that, and we won't discuss these at length, provided that it's Eno Nechal Kemoshu Hai, it's Olea Shulchan Melachim, the specific type of food, which when you enter into a restaurant is probably going to be the type of food you're going to be eating. There's a problem called Bishule Goyim, that's Siman Kuf Yod Gimal, Saif Aleph, Saif Dalet, Shulchan Aruch continues, and he says, Yesh mi shematir bishvachot shelanu, v'yesh mi sheoser, v'afilu b'di'avad. If it's not a non-Jew who's making it for you in a happy, extending themselves way, but rather they're working for you, they're employed by you. There's a question about what shivahot means, but he says shivahot shelanu. Appears to be talking about someone who's employed for you. There are those who permit. In other words, why would you permit? The issue of bishul akum is too much closeness. I'm not going to get very close to my employee. I will get close to my next door neighbor, and my son will marry his daughter, not to my employee per se. But Shulchan Aruch says v'yesh mi she'osir, and generally speaking, when Shulchan Aruch has yesh v'yesh halacha ki yesh omrim batra, so he seems to be stringent on this as well. So the fact that their employees in the back of the store, in the front of the store, won't help a svaradi all that much. Rama says, "Ubdi avad yesh lismocha divrei matirim." Rama, Rabbi Moshe Yisilis of Ashkenazim, says, "Listen, unideal, but you could have a sense of leniency." Not the Sephardic approach to this matter. Saif Zayin says Shulchan Aruch, you should know that Shkirat Hatanur in Amoilet El Bepat. If you're just igniting the fire or stoking the flames or whatever the circumstance is, it's not sufficient for Bishul Akum. It is for Patakum for specific reasons. Bread is considered a staple, so the rabbis were lenient, but not for cooked foods, says Rama. Not true. We are lenient on this matter as well. What emerges uncharacteristically is that Shulchan Aruch is stringent on seemingly all the possible avenues of leniency in the context of Bishul Akum, and Rama, Rabbi Moshe Yisilis, is lenient. Now, if it weren't written in Art Scroll, I perhaps wouldn't suggest this publicly, but I will tell you, the Art Scroll book, Rabbi Forrest, I think, is his name, from Far Rockaway. He writes, in a footnote, if I remember correctly, it's been a while, he writes, you should know, it appears as if in the inspiration toward the stringencies of Shulchan Aruch and leniencies of Rama on these particular issues has to do with their place, their way of living. The Middle Eastern Sephardic Jews were, generally speaking, very inculcated into the society, living side by side non-Jewish neighbors. As a result, they were a little bit more careful, or a lot more careful in terms of the foods, because of a fear of intermarriage. The Ashkenazic ones, who were segmented and sent away, or cloistered in their ghettos or in their shtetls, had less of a fear, and as a result, it developed over time that they were more lenient in issues with regards to non-Jews and non-Jewish cooking. But I remain on the question that I began with: is it okay for us to eat in the establishments, the restaurants in Brooklyn? Because if they don't do it according to the Sephardic way, so it's true, they have Ashkenazic hechsher. How are we eating there? Perhaps we shouldn't be eating there. Would Chacham Avadya Yosef tell us not to eat in the restaurants in Brooklyn? Ironically, he'll be the one telling us, Yesh al mi lismoch. It'll be just about every other Sephardic rabbi telling us that you should not. Well, just in terms of practice throughout the generations, in source 24 and 25, this is 19th century, early 19th and mid 19th century sources, Rav Pe'alim is Ben Ish Chai and Chilek Dalet Siman Vav, Ziv Chesedek is Chama Abdallah Somech, also a Baghdadian 19th century rabbi. They point out separately that Saif Dalet and Saif Zayin in source number 23 were both accepted by the Baghdadian, sounds like across the board from other sources, Middle Eastern Jewry. Don't think this was in Shulchan Aruch, but we didn't practice this way. We did practice this way. We would not be lenient on matters of just turning on the oven and letting the non-Jew cook it, and we would not be lenient when it was just the worker who was doing it for you. It was something that was kept carefully, at least in Baghdad 19th century, but several, many other sources seem to suggest this is not one of those issues, which was, and here's the interesting thing, it's different than our earlier sources. Our earlier sources appeared as if for hundreds of years this was the practice against Shulchan Aruch. This one, I'm telling you, the sources seem to be telling us that Sfaradi, Middle Eastern descended Jews, have been scrupulous on these matters, unlike the Brooklyn restaurants. All right, so what are we to do? Says Chacham Mordechai Eliyahu in source number 26, of course, chief rabbi after Chacham Ovadia Yosef, in his Ma'amar Mordechai Chalek Bet Yorei De'asiman Dalet. There's no room for leniency over here. I can't permit anything. If you walk into a restaurant and they don't have the Jewish person putting the food onto the flame, it's not kosher. Rabbinically speaking, albeit certainly, but it's not kosher for you to eat there. That's Chacham Mordechai Eliyahu writes. Chacham Mordechai Eliyahu was renowned for his love of Jews. He got along with Jews from all ends of the spectrum. Says in source number 28, Rabbi Mazuz, don't think it's because he was lenient in halacha all the time. Sometimes people have a way of endearing themselves through being lenient. Says Chacham Mordechai Eliyahu, like on this matter, took a strong stance. If Shulchan Aruch says it's forbidden, it's forbidden. He was beloved because he was a loving person, not because he was lenient in halacha. That, of course, is in contrast in terms of this leniency to Chacham Ovadia Yosef in source number 27. In She'elot Tishuboti Havedat Chelekei Siman Nundalet, Chacham Ovadia Yosef was posed with the following question. Not Brooklyn restaurants, but rather restaurants in Israel with Rabbanut HaRashit Hashkaha. Rabbanut HaRashit Hashkaha, apparently, it does not is not scrupulous to, according to the Sephardic customs and halachot of Bishul Akum. Can tayarim, can American or whatever, outside of Israel, Jews, who are coming and eating in those places, this is dangerous, we're misleading Sephardic people, is there something al mili smoch, or do we need to make a kolkore? Do we need to put up signs and make clear that Sfaradim shouldn't be eating in these establishments, as several others made clear they believed should be so? Says Chaim Ovadia Yosef, I have a way of rationalizing. What? Really? That's right. But Shulchan Aruch, source number 23, Shulchan Aruch told us you have to do it this way. Yeah, okay, says Chaim Ovadia Yosef, I'll make what's called a safek sefika. Maybe halacha is in source number 23 like Saif Dalit, and if it's not, maybe halacha is like Saif Zayin. What's Saif Dal and Saif Zayin? Maybe the halacha is that since it's an employee who's working, so that already permits the food for you. Why does that permit the food? Well, after all, there are some opinions who say that if it's an employee, there's no problem of Bishul Akum. Now maybe you'll tell me, no, we follow the Humrah opinion. Well, maybe the halacha is like halacha Zayin, that as long as I lit the flame, it's sufficient in terms of establishing that it's not Bishul Akum. That's his suggestions called Safik Sifika. I have twofold holes in my page. Right, Ricky? There's the hole, poking holes in the page. And says Chaim Ovadia Yosef, that's the room, that's the grounds to be a Mekil. Of course, this is not a simple Safik Sifika, because Shulchan Aruch told us the halacha in both of these. And Saif Dalit, he told us, it's Asur. And Saif Zayin, he told us, it's Asur as well. It's like you're walking into the room and saying, okay, so Rabbi, you told me this might be Mutai, this might be Asur. You said it's Asur. Then the next thing you told me might be mutar, might be asur, and you said it's asur, but you gave two options on both of them, so let's be lenient. What do you mean? I took a stance on both of them. Says Chaim Ovadia Yosef, clearly and unequivocally, I think nir'ah lelamed zechut ala noagim lahakil badavar. If you're mahmir, tavu alav beracha, he writes at the end. In other words, that's a nice thing to be mahmir. But if you want to eat in this establishment in Brooklyn, in Rabbanut, if that's the only issue of Bishul Akum in this fashion, it's permitted even for Sfaradim. It's a very bold claim. Methodologically, it's a little problematic because you're claiming that Shulchan Aruch was uncertain in each of those laws, even though he makes those laws clear. That's Chaim Ovadia Yosef being consistent with his general approach. Shulchan Aruch lays it out as he understands it. He doesn't close the book on you. That's a point we mentioned earlier. That's his claim. Everyone disagrees with him. Everyone, I mean, the Sephardic rabbis of the world at the time, the notorious ones. In source number 29, in the Hakdamat She'elot Tishbot Or Lizion Chelek Bet, Chaim Ben Zion Abba Shaul says, absolutely not. You can't make a safek sefeka. The words of Shulchan Aruch are vaday. We know this already from Rabbi Yaakov Chaim Sofer in a previous class. To use the religious words, they're written Beruach HaKodesh. It's done. He made the Pesach Halacha. It's over. And as a result, there's no, maybe this, maybe that. No. No and no. And as a result, no plus no equals no times two. You can't eat in these establishments, says Chacham Ben Zion Abba Shaul. Chacham Ovadia Yosef, in his Yabia Omer later in Chelek Tet, defends himself. He says it's not so. They're on a methodological back and forth. Is Shulchan Aruch written Betorat Vaday or Betorat Safik? Says Chacham Ovadia Yosef, Betorat Safik. Says Chacham Ben Zion, Betorat Vaday. In other words, can I still consider it a Safik or not? That, as again, we've mentioned, is a methodological dispute. Rabbi Shalom Masas, who oftentimes is mekil on matters, but more often than not, follows tradition, says on this matter, you have to be mahmir. You can't just eat in these restaurants. I don't care if a Jew is turning on the flame. You can't be so mech leakel on that matter. The safik sefika is a shaky safik sefika. Shulchan Aruch could have and should have made this clear had this really been his contention. In Saif Dalit, Saif Zayin, he seems to have a progression of halachot. He doesn't seem to distinguish. Chaim Ovadia Yosef responds to him as well in Yabia Omer Chelek Tet. And then he's disputed on that in source 34. From a contemporary, I just bought this book, Simchat Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda Azulai, who defends the counter argument to Chaim Ovadia Yosef. It's interesting, and I'll conclude with this and then piece it all together, that in source 33, Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, who dies at the end of the 20th century, was the rabbi of Tel Aviv Yafo. I think I mentioned Rabbi Mark Angel wrote a biography on him. In his book, Aseh Lecha Rav Chelek Tet, in Siman Yod Bet, I'm just giving you one paragraph or one sentence, one or two sentences. Me'ata. And he says, now let's analyze. He's dealing with our issue. Again, a restaurant in which a Jewish person's turning on the flame, but a non-Jewish person is cooking the food and putting it on. Kan be'arsenu, here in Israel. En iyodea ketzad nahagu avotenu ba'avar. I don't know what happened 100 years ago. But what I can tell you is what's going on today. Aval dorenu kvar hinhig heter betabachim goyim haskurim lanu. You hear that? He says, our generation has already accepted likula with these non-Jewish cooks who are in the back with a Jewish person lighting the flame. He concludes and he says, I'm not so excited about this. And you should look at the words of Ben Ishchai, who says that anyone who has a proper brain in their head should be mahmir. But he does. And for anyone who has argued differently in these classes or outside, that halakha has become ossified and static, well, here it is, a circumstance in which it's clear. We mentioned Ziv HaTzedek, we mentioned Rav Pe'alim Chelek Dalet. This was a matter which Sfaradim were scrupulous, were stringent on for quite some time. Circumstances changed. We're not living amongst non-Jews as much any longer. The cooks are Arabs, they're not Christians, they're in those circumstances less threatening and so forth. I'm not bringing that into the determination of the halakha, but I am mentioning it as perhaps why things began to change, says Rabbi Chaim David Halevi. They already are noheg heter. I'm not excited about it, but they are noheg heter. What's Chacham Ovadia Yosef's reaction to it? Uncharacteristically, for a third time, but this time, not even a minhag for hundreds of years. A minhag for 50 years, 60 years, at most. When did we start having restaurants as an establishment in Israel in which we could employ non-Jewish people? Says Chacham Ovadia Yosef on this matter, I will defend and rationalize what has become the nohag hanafutz b'yamenu. So in turn, I conclude and I tell you, we talked about Chacham Ovadia Yosef's approach to Pesach Halacha, generally speaking, as I prefaced. We've pointed out how against the norm, he will stand by the text, by the textual tradition, as opposed to what we've called the mimetic tradition or the practice tradition. On these three circumstances, of course, in addition to a handful of others, not the majority of his Piskei Halacha, he ironically takes the other approach. He says, this is the practice, and I will provide the texts for that tradition. We addressed Minhag Gedola being a Lecha Tehila, being a viable option, even in ideal circumstances. We then talked about women who leave their head uncovered for Berachot. And lastly, we addressed the Bishul Akum in a circumstance where a Jewish person ignited the flame and the non-Jewish person put the food on. Although in each of these circumstances, Shulchan Aruch is clear and unequivocal as to, maybe the second one, a little bit different, Eddie pointed out. But generally speaking, we assume clear in each of these circumstances that he thinks you should be stringent. The minhag, the nohag, is contrary to his words. And in each of these circumstances, Chacham Ovadia Yosef stands behind that minhag and not only does so with his words, he does it with his pen by providing textual sources and foundations for them. Baruch Adonai le'olam. Amen v'amen.